Our scripture reading this morning, we're taken from the book of Mark, chapter 9, verses 1 through 13. Mark chapter 9, verses 1 through 13. And he said to them, "I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God come with power." After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, "Why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him."
Thank you, Adrian, for that scriptural reading. As we get started here this morning, I want to tell you that I could compile a long list of phrases that people use that make me roll my eyes, phrases that people use that annoy me. I probably won't make such a list, but be careful. One of my least favorite phrases for someone to say to me, or to say in general, is, "You just had to be there," right? You just had to be there. I think one of the main reasons that that tends to get on my nerves is really because I think, not all the time, but maybe a majority of the time, it's used to cover up a really horrible offense, which is an inside joke that was never funny to begin with. Right? I think that we all kind of know how these inside jokes work, which is that it's really only funny if you're at the right place, at the right time, with the right group of people, and otherwise, it's really probably not as funny as we think that it is. I think for a lot of us, if we have an inside joke like that, my hope and prayer is that we can look back like 10 or 15 years later and we can recognize that it wasn't that funny. And to show some self-reflection, I'm gonna do that for us now. When I was in high school, I remember one night my friends and I went to a grocery store and we walked around down all the aisles trying to find whole wheat cheese. You heard me right, whole wheat cheese. The entire point of the joke is that you can't find that because it doesn't exist, because cheese is not made out of wheat. To the best of my memory, the best of my knowledge, I'm not missing any details. That was the whole joke. That was it. Like, they say that the best comedians leave you wanting more, and I think that's also true of the worst comedians. But yeah, for the next few years, we thought it was so funny. My friends and I would try to drop this in random sentences just to get each other to laugh, and it would work because we all thought it was hilarious because we were high school boys and we were stupid. And about a month from now, we are going to celebrate an awesome group of seniors, of high school graduates, and I'll have more to say to them on that day, but I figured I could go ahead and give them a valuable lesson right now, free of charge, that high school jokes don't always work in college. You might want to leave those at home. I do remember, I don't remember the context, but I remember trying this out in front of my freshman year roommate and my girlfriend. And I said, whole wheat cheese. And I explained the whole story. And I was like, it's because we were at a grocery store. Get it? It's because you can't have whole wheat cheese. And it did not land. My roommate's name was Jacob. It's Jacob. He's one of my really good friends to this day. And my girlfriend's name was Holly. And she still doesn't think my jokes are very funny. But sorry to Holly. You just had to be there. But really, another reason that I don't like that phrase is it feels exclusive to tell somebody that you just had to be there. It's like everyone is all talking about a party that you didn't get invited to, right? It just feels like we're not in on the joke. It feels like exclusive, that we're not supposed to get that. But as much as that phrase does rub me the wrong way, I think that there can be truth in that concept and that idea, that there are some moments that really can't be adequately represented after the fact. There are some moments that you can't write accurate enough words or descriptions. You can't even show a picture and have it do justice. I think that there are moments that really just have to be experienced. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. It's really an incredible story that Adrian had us read through earlier. It's really a turning point, I think, in the Gospel of Mark, and it has really vivid imagery and so much to read and study. But right now, first, I actually want us to back up a little bit. Like I said, this is chapter 9. Really, throughout the book of Mark, and I would say about the first 7 or so chapters, it becomes more and more clear to everyone that Jesus is special. Because he teaches with authority. Because Jesus is a miracle worker. He casts out demons. And he feeds the 4,000 pretty soon before this story. But even through all the amazing things that Jesus is doing and how special it's clear that he is, it is also clear that no one quite knows really who Jesus is or what Jesus is actually doing. And then finally, in Mark chapter 8, one chapter before this, we have a really special moment where Jesus talks to his disciples. And I won't have us read it, but I'll try my best to recount kind of how this story goes. That Jesus looks at his disciples and he asks them, who do people say that I am? Which I love that question, first of all, because he's basically saying, what are people saying about me? Which I think maybe you and I are tempted to ask that question sometimes. We're tempted to know the answer to that. But I think Jesus has a different reason for asking you. What do people say about me? And Peter responds, and he says, some say that you are John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. And still others say that you are one of the prophets. And then we have a moment where Jesus says, basically, that's great, but who do you say that I am? And we have what we now call Peter's confession, where Peter says, you are the Messiah. You are the Messiah. I think Peter is one of those characters in the Bible that either kind of gets a bad rap, or maybe we see ourselves in Peter. And we have moments where he kind of puts his foot in his mouth, where he doesn't say the right thing. But I love that in this moment, he speaks the truth, and he speaks it clearly. And he declares rightly that Jesus is the Messiah. And I think in this moment, we are now tempted to think that we understand everything that Jesus is, and that his disciples now have a great idea of who Jesus is, and that they've gotten the answer right. But I think they still don't clearly actually understand what that means. Peter speaks truth, but he doesn't know what it means. See, everyone wanted a Messiah. John the Baptist was great. Elijah, that would have been even better. And the prophets, that's incredible. But the people of Israel really wanted something more. They wanted a savior. The problem is they didn't know what that meant. They wanted a Messiah to overthrow Rome. They wanted a Messiah to rule Israel as a king, which is what they were going to get, but they didn't know what that really meant. The truth is that their imaginations weren't big enough to comprehend what the Messiah could actually do. And the transfiguration of Jesus is powerful because it shows us exactly what that means. Jesus is more. So Jesus' clothes become radiant, right? More white than anyone could ever bleach them. And another phrase that we have this morning, another phrase I have for you, is you'll know it when you see it. And there are times this gets on my nerves, especially I think like if you're asking for directions, it's not very helpful. Say you'll know it when you see it, right? Not the most helpful way to give directions. But I think that there are a few moments I can point to where, again, there's truth in these words, and sometimes it's just true. And one that I think of is if you have ever been to Carlsbad Caverns, which I've been maybe four or five times at this point. I went there with our youth group last year. And if you go, first of all, piece of advice, I'll give you two in the next couple of minutes. First piece of advice, if you ever go to Carlsbad Caverns, don't take the elevator down. Walk down the natural entrance, and then you can take the elevator back up. But I remember being kind of, not worried, I was following the path, but thinking, like, am I going to know when I get to the cave? Like, what if I get lost? Like, what if I don't know where the path goes the first time I went? And then you start to walk down, and you see this massive yawning opening in the earth that seems like it's just going to swallow you whole, and you walk down into it. I remember thinking that I had just been told that it was discovered, this cave was discovered at least by modern humans in the early 20th century, and I just remember thinking, how could anyone have missed this before that? It's just one of those moments that you'll know it if you see it. And another one that I thought about is if you have ever seen a solar eclipse. And my second piece of advice for you is that if you have never seen a total solar eclipse, then you haven't really seen a solar eclipse. because there's a difference. And I remember watching the eclipse, and you could track how much of the sun was covered. And I remember seeing, oh, the sun is 50%, or it's gotten up to 80%, or 90%. And even at 99, it still looked like a normal day outside, but getting a little bit darker. And then finally, the moon totally covered the sun. It was like everything changed. The temperature drops instantly, like 10 or 15 degrees, it felt like. The birds actually started chirping. The crickets started chirping. It was just night in the middle of the day. And that was an incredible experience. And it is another one where you'll know it when you see it. It is just undeniable. And I think that we have some of these moments where something that is ambiguous becomes unambiguous. And I love this story because Peter, James, and John got to experience the unambiguous glory and purity of Jesus on that mountain. in a way that was truly unmistakable, and it was undeniable. I love the wording here, that his clothes became radiant and intensely white as no one on earth could bleach them. And what I love is that it is still a moment where you just had to be there, right? It seems like we're getting a description, but I want you to think about the description we're actually getting. We are not told how radiant and how bright and how white Jesus' clothes actually are. All we're told is that it is more than they can be bleached. We are only told that it is more than what words could describe, because in this moment, Jesus is so powerful and so radiant that words aren't big enough to truly capture Jesus. In looking over this passage, there was a commentary that I read. They referred to this mountain in this moment. It used the phrase, it said that this was a suburb of heaven. A suburb of heaven. And I love that language, that in this moment, heaven breaks through, a heavenly reality breaks through into an earthly reality. And after that, nothing is really the same anymore. That Jesus completely and literally outshined everybody else. That Jesus is more. And so I mentioned that in this moment, there aren't words big enough to capture it. That there aren't words big enough to capture what's going on, to capture who Jesus is. And so I want us to look at this next passage while we're on that subject. So Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And then verse 6, he did not know what to say. They were so frightened. I think in the last chapter that we talked about, that Peter raised his hand and he said, "Yes, Jesus, you're the Messiah," and he got the right answer. And then maybe he got a little overconfident, maybe thought he was on a hot streak. And so in this moment, he is babbling. He doesn't know what to say. And he says something. And this time, he kind of strikes out. I think it's a rule often that needs to be followed in public speaking or in preaching, that you really should never start a sentence without knowing how it's going to end. And I think in this moment, that's what Peter does, unfortunately. He said something wrong. He was incorrect. But I think his mistake is understandable, because Peter sees the glory of Jesus, and he just wants to stay in that moment forever. He can't think of anything better than being with Moses and being with Elijah and being with Jesus. Moses led God's people out of slavery. Elijah performed miracles, and he proclaimed God's truth. But the truth is that Jesus did all of that and more, that Jesus' plans were really just beginning. They weren't confined to this moment, because Jesus is more. So even in the midst of Peter's foolish statement, I really like that Peter still speaks the truth. Even though his whole idea is wrong, he still speaks truly when he says, "It is good for us to be here. It is good for us to be here." I find this moment comforting because Peter kind of opens his mouth and accidentally stumbles into the truth. And he didn't even mean to say it. But as Christians, I think we are all guilty of doing this. We're all guilty of maybe saying too much or doing too much. We are guilty of misrepresenting Jesus, not just with our words, but also with our actions. And my prayer is that Jesus is so pure and holy and radiant that people will see the truth of Jesus even in spite of us, of our tendency to hinder that, because Jesus is more. And finally, verse 7, it says, "Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. 'This is my son whom I love, listen to him.' Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus." I think verse 8 might be overlooked in this passage and in this story that has so many other exciting things going on. But it's actually my favorite detail in the whole passage, is that when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone except Jesus. I think it is really easy to see other things, to see everything else. It's easy to be distracted by finances and test grades and interpersonal relationships and news cycles and insurance claims and all the other little things that we worry about, and to be distracted by bigger things, suffering and brokenness, like addiction and sin. These things are real. These things do matter. They're important. But ultimately, I think that they do distract us. I think that the most dangerous distraction that we have is actually the misinformed concept of Jesus that we already have in our own heads. Because we are in trouble if we've already decided who Jesus is, or if we've already decided what Jesus can do. I think our imaginations need to be bigger. Because I promise you that Jesus is more. And maybe it's not as easy to see now, but as Christians, we believe there will be a day when the whole world and all of creation will see the unambiguous glory and purity of Christ, when every knee bows and tongue confesses that he is Lord. And in that moment, you'll know it when you see it, and you will just have to be there. We'll now invite us, if you have any needs, if you have any needs of prayer or to put on Christ in baptism, to come forward as we stand and sing.